is going to be, admittedly, a rather different Christmas sermon. How many of you know what I'm talking about when I say Coney 2012? Any of you know what I'm talking about? Most of you did know. You've forgotten. This was the name of a 28-minute video produced by an American charity named Invisible Children. It was released on March the 5th, 2012 on YouTube. And by 7 months later, October 2012, the site had been viewed more than 97 million times. It created quite a stir in the entire world. The video chronicles the atrocities committed by a guerrilla group, the Lord's Resistance Army, and its leader, Joseph Kony, against the children of Uganda, Sudan, Congo, Central African Republic since 1987. I want to give you a brief history of those atrocities. In 1986, the National Resistance Army overthrew the government in Uganda and attempted to occupy that country. The next year, 1987, beginning all the way to 1994, there was resistance movement that called itself the Lord's Resistance Army. And it began a bloody civil war to overthrow the new government. And the sad thing about it was that the people were caught in between all of this warring. Both sides brutally attacked villages for supplies and replenishing their soldiers. The Lord's Resistance Army, led by Kony, is said to have tortured and killed around 100,000 citizens, abducted an estimated 24,000 to 38,000 children who were forced to serve as soldiers or sex slaves for the military. More than 2 million people were displaced from their homes and fled as refugees to surrounding countries. In 2012, let's fast forward ahead. In 2012, a military coalition was formed by four African countries, Uganda, South Sudan, Central African Republic, and Congo. The U.S. provided for this effort 100 military advisors. The purpose was to locate and to take out Kony and his Lord's Resistance Army. To date, over 1.5 years later, after this coalition was formed, Kony has not yet been captured. The LRA is reportedly to have been reduced to approximately 200 core fighters who are still attacking villages. As you might imagine, there are literally millions and millions of stories that could be told from every individual, every country's side about these, but I want to take you to a particular country for one of those stories. The British ruled Sudan basically, essentially, unofficially as two separate countries. North Sudan was populated primarily by Muslims. South Sudan was populated primarily by, quote, Christians. When Britain granted independence to this country in 1956, they had, for all practical purposes, integrated the two countries together and declared Arabic as the official language. Consequently, when the new government was formed, only a very small, extreme minority of southern leaders were incorporated into that government. Now, fast forward to 1983. A major oil field is discovered on the border between North and South Sudan. Sudan's Arab president declared, in an effort to make sure that he controlled all the oil, that Sudan would officially become a Muslim state ruled by Sharia law. Sharia law, as you likely know, is the moral and religious law of Islam. The people of South Sudan formed a resistance that they called the Sudanese People's Liberation Army. The ensuing war, civil war, is known as the Second Sudanese Civil War. It lasted officially from 1983 to 2005. The government Muslim forces invaded the South with orders to kill all of the boys. Particularly targeted were those between the age of 5 and 13, so that they would not grow up and join the army. The resulting instability provided the opportunity for Kony's Lord's Resistance Army to take refuge in this war-torn South Sudan. His presence further complicated an already desperate situation for the people of South Sudan, but the primary aggressors in southern Sudan was the Islamic government forces from the north part of that country. But this sets the stage for the flight of over 20,000 boys who will come to be known as the Lost Boys of Sudan. Some of you are familiar with that story. The name was taken from a name given to the group of orphan boys that were led by Peter Pan, a 1953 Disney movie. And I want to give you a brief summary of their flight. And I've worked on this for several weeks now and have had great difficulty in cutting this down to a very brief summary, but this will be my effort to give you a brief summary. The Lost Boys of Sudan is that name given to a group of over 20,000 boys of two particular tribes in South Sudan, the Nuer tribe and the Dinka tribe. They were displaced and are orphaned during the Second Sudanese Civil War. About 2.5 million people were killed, and millions more were displaced from their homes. Many of the boys were orphans. They were separated from their families when the government troops and the rebels from the north systematically attacked the village of southern Sudan, killing many of its inhabitants. Many of these young boys avoided capture or death because they were able to flee to the jungles, the bush in Africa. Those who fled by foot for years would be searching for a safe refuge, literally for years, on a journey that carried them over 1,000 miles across three different countries to refugee camps where they resided in Ethiopia, Kenya, and in various villages where they sought refuge in South Sudan. Over half of them died along this epic journey due to starvation, dehydration, sickness, disease. They were attacked by wild animals and constantly being attacked by enemy soldiers. Experts say that these are the most badly war-traumatized children that have ever been examined. Beginning in 2001, as a part of a program established by the United States government and the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, approximately 3,800 boys were allowed to resettle in the United States. This effort was halted at 9/11 for security reasons. The program was restarted in 2004. An additional number of lost boys have been allowed to come into the United States. A variety of programs have been initiated to help these displaced people in areas of education, medical assistance, reconnecting with families in South Sudan, and rebuilding efforts and providing humanitarian aid in southern Sudan. In 2005, an agreement was signed between the North and South Sudan, allowing free access to these lost boys and girls, and Sudanese scattered people around the world were allowed to return to their homeland. As a result, many are now returning to South Sudan to pay it forward and to help the rebuilding of this war-torn country and provide humanitarian aid and support in whatever way they can. In January of 2011, 99.47% of South Sudanese voted to separate from the North and become an independent nation. And so this is the newest nation in our world today. Some American former lost boys and girls now hold positions in the current government of South Sudan. I want to quickly tell you, as quickly as I can, excerpt from one boy's story. He was 12 years old at that time. His name was John Dow. And let me just listen as I tell you how he wrote his story, and I'll just take a small excerpt from it. One night as I slept, it was August, the rainy season, 1987, I began to hear a dull thumping that seemed to be slapping me in the ear. In my sleep, it was just something annoying, but when I woke up and scrambled outside the crowded hut that I shared with other children, everyone was running. The sky was lit up by mortar blasts. I saw my father run past, so I ran after him. The women and children were running and crying. I could hear bullets zinging whistling past us. I can still hear that sound. I thought the end of the world that the Bible talks about was here. I kept running, following my father out of the village into the bush. And he kneeled down in the tall grass to watch for the soldiers, and I caught up to him. It was not my father. It was our neighbor, Abraham. He told me to be very quiet. He grabbed me, and as we crawled through the tall grass to the bush, I was so scared. "Where's my family?" I asked. "They're coming. They're coming," he said. And he pulled me by the arm and made me keep running, dragging me along with him. And I could hear Abraham's heart pounding. At dawn, we met a woman and her two girls from our village, and we joined them, heading east toward Ethiopia, where we thought we would be safe. My knees were scraped from falling as we ran. My feet were bloody. I was naked because I had left the village that way. None of us had taken anything as we fled. No food, no cooking pots. We ate almost nothing. Wild roots, a pumpkin from a farmer's field. At night, the mosquitoes would torment us as we tried to sleep. And then he continues telling about that they were twice ambushed and beaten. Even the clothes that the adult man had that was with him were taken away. Then he tells about in one of those assaults, the woman and the two girls were abducted and they never saw them again. Then he says, "What horrified me most was the night. I was afraid of wild animals, leopards, hyenas. It was very, very cold, about 40 degrees. I had no clothes or covering to stay warm. I would sleep close to Abraham." It went on like this for several weeks. And then he tells about joining up with a group of 19 others, how they were attacked by hostile tribes as they went through their areas. We moved on looking for water. We were crying because we were so thirsty, but no tears came. We wanted to stop, give up, but Abraham kept pushing us to move on, saying we would find water soon. When we did not, some of the boys refused to go on. At last, we found a muddy pool. We threw ourselves into it and ate the mud, just for the moisture. It had been days since we had water to drink. Our tongues were swollen. Our skins were gray. We couldn't talk. Now, only four of us boys were left with Abraham. Along the path, we saw dead bodies, sometimes vultures eating them. I prayed. I sang Christian songs in my mind to ask for water. Then the second day, we came to a swampy area and ran into it and drank and drank. Then later, finally, in late November, we made it to a refugee camp on the Sudan-Ethiopian border. We had spent 4 months trying to reach it. And this is not necessarily from that camp. It's just a picture that I took off the internet of a refugee camp in that area. It says refugees were pouring in to this particular camp. The UN did not arrive until weeks later. Soon, cholera hit the camp. Life became very bad. My boys, he had been assigned 120 boys, or 200 boys, to watch over because he was one of the older ones at 12 years old at that point. But my boys were dying all around me. I was trying to help them, but I could not. If they became sick in the morning, they would be dead by afternoon. We dug shallow graves in the dirt with sticks in our hands just a few inches deep to bury them. But their limbs became stiff after a few hours and poked up out of the ground. At night, hyenas would come and eat the bodies. Some of the boys began to act crazy. They could not take the horrors. It was a terrible time. After the cholera epidemic, other diseases attacked. Measles, chickenpox, whooping cough. They killed a lot more boys. I don't know why I survived. Maybe it was something that God planned. After 4 years at this particular camp, adults at the camp told us that we must flee because the camp was going to be attacked by locals. The only choice we had was to cross back into Sudan. Then we all left the camp together, 27,000 of us, almost all boys, walking down a narrow pass, single file. The line went on for days. We got to the Hilo River. It was very full and strong, and we could see crocodiles awaiting from shore. We were gathered there on the riverbank when suddenly Ethiopian rebels attacked, firing on us. I dived into the river and began swimming as hard as I could. Another boy dived almost on top of me, but he could not swim, and he clutched at me. I tried to help him, but I didn't have the strength, and the river was forcing both of us under. I had to leave him. Somehow, I made it to the other side. We lost about 9,000 boys and a few men that day on the Hilo River. But 18,000 of us, mostly Dinka boys, had made it back to our homeland. And then he tells, for the next 6 months, the boys suffered starvation, thirst, ambushes, bombing attacks by the Sudanese government. Some 800 boys eventually made it to a refugee camp in northern Kenya, and he spent the next 10 years there. He grew up there. He is now in America, and he has written a documentary called something to the effect that God got tired of us. Now, I want to read you another boy's story. His name, I'll tell you in just a moment. Many, and this is what he wrote at my request. Many South Sudanese children were lost during the Civil War in 1986 and 1988. Most of the lost boys went to Ethiopia and lived in refugee camps. They got their food from UN Refugee Agency. At that time, I was not a lost boy. I lived with my parents. When the Ethiopian regime was overthrown, refugees were returned to South Sudan. Lost boys went to Kenya and Uganda, where many lost their lives on the way. I and my parents returned back to Upper Nile State in Nasser in 1991, and that's on the northern border of what is now South Sudan. In 1995, the war broke out in Upper Nile, and our city, Nasser, was destroyed. I was separated from my parents when our house was bombed. I ran with the other boys whose parents had been killed, and he was at this time 12 years old. On the way to Ethiopia, some of us were killed by lions because we ran to the forest. Some died from hunger because we did not carry food with us. We were little boys with no power to carry food while we were running. We just ate fruits and leaves. When we tried to beg, no one gave us anything because the food they had was for their own children. We spent 22 days on the way. Some in our group died from hunger and thirst. Some boys ate the flesh of other dead boys. Some died from infection from eating that human flesh. When we arrived in Ethiopia, we received food, tents, and medicines from the United Nations. After 1 month, we were taken to Penyundo refugee camp. Some boys found their relatives and lived with them. Some did not. I did not find any relatives. One lady tried to adopt me. She named me Moses. After 1 year, she told me that she could not support me because of her other children. I left her and lived with another boy. In 2005, I got resettlement and came to the U.S. I had lived for 18 years without knowing where my parents were. I thought they were dead. In 2011, I heard that some of my family was alive. In 2012, after I got my citizenship, I went to my home, Nasser, and found some of them alive. My mother did not recognize me. She thought that I was dead. When I introduced myself to her, she was crying. My uncle killed the ox and called my relatives to let them know David is alive. Many came and made celebration for my coming. They could not believe that I was alive. Now, I want to introduce to you one of the lost boys of Sudan. His name is David Thotmer. Is that correct? Thotmer. And I want David to stand up so that you'll see one of the lost boys from Sudan, your Christian brother. Now, do you understand why I wanted to use this sermon for today? Because I knew that he was going to be with us. David met Tyrone Minear in Gambela, Ethiopia in July 2012. And David asked Tyrone if he could help him attend Sunset International Bible Institute to train to be a preacher, to go back to South Sudan and to try to help his people. Tyrone agreed, and David is scheduled to graduate in September 2014. That is, if he can secure adequate support to be able to continue, because that support has run out at present. David was married in the summer of 2012. Is that correct, David? Summer of 2012. His wife is in Gambela, Ethiopia. He's not able to bring her over here to be with him at this time. He plans to rejoin her upon graduation and work with Tyrone as an evangelist and a school instructor in a school that's planned for his home, Nasser, South Sudan. And so I want to say on behalf of this congregation, David, God bless you. And your story is a very inspiring story. And it breaks our heart that somebody would have to live through the kind of things that you have and suffer the losses that you have. And it touches our heart very deeply. And it occurs to me that I don't know why David was born in the Sudan. And I don't know why I was born in the United States of America, because neither one of us had anything to say about that. Our roles could have been very easily switched. And so I want to say to all of you today, I wish you a happy and safe and peaceful holiday season filled with good friends, good food, family, and peace. And as I have studied about this and come to know something more about it, it occurs to me that I know this is a very strange Christmas sermon, but I wanted to take advantage of this opportunity to remind us of how incredibly blessed we are. And to also realize that there are places and people in our world at this very moment who know nothing and have not known anything of peace and security and prosperity that God has blessed us with in their entire life. And I'd like to take just a second to give you an update. Even though now South Sudan has declared its independence and is a new nation, in July 2011, when South Sudan gained its independence and installed a new government, the president of that new government was from the Dinka tribe. The vice president was from the Nuer tribe, which is David's tribe. And in April 2013, the president became paranoid about the vice president and fired him with accusations of attempting a coup. And today, at this moment, there are 30,000-plus refugees seeking refuge in the capital city of South Sudan because there appears to be, as Tyrone mentioned a little bit earlier, a coming civil war again. And I think about all of the heartache and all of the fighting that has gone on in that part of the country. And you think about the countries that fight against one another, tribes that fight against one another, the North against the South, and the fighting that went on there. And finally, they gained their independence. And then even after that, now the major tribes are fighting against one another. And when we talk about fighting, we're talking about slaughter of people. Things like trying to exterminate all the males in a tribe. Sometimes God gives us an opportunity not only to find out about things like this that involve our brothers and sisters, but also He gives us an opportunity to share. Now may the Lord of peace Himself give you peace at all times and in every way. The Lord be with you all. 2 Thessalonians 3:16. It occurs to me that for a people who've never known a moment's peace in their life, and you think, what could we do? Because now that country is awash with automatic weapons left over from the Civil War. And now there are just millions of automatic weapons in the hands of practically anybody that wants to get it. What would you do to bring peace? Would you take away all the guns? They have machetes. Would you take away all the machetes? How could you possibly bring peace to that area? And it occurs to me there's only one way, and that is through Jesus Christ. There is no other peace. There might be very brief periods of respite, but there is no peace. There is nothing to calm men's heart and the hostility and the anger and the greed in men's heart except Jesus Christ. And And the only hope that that country has, and the only hope that this country has, is the peace that comes from our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. I'm going to ask you to keep David, his family, those people, that those Christians that are hiding in the bush right now because of the intense fighting. This past week, one incident in this camp of 30,000 refugees, the rebels broke in under the protection, this group under the protection of UN forces. They broke into that camp and killed 500 people at one time. It's a horrible place to have to live right now. So I'm going to ask you to keep them in your prayers. And as we enjoy a safe, happy holiday season, let's remember that not everybody is safe and secure at this time. And let's pray that the gospel will touch their hearts as well as our own hearts while we stand and sing. Would you